Welcome to the audio podcast of The Table at Central United Methodist Church. The podcast currently features the messages of Matt Smith and Linda Du Hirsu,
with a musical introduction by Brendan Lowe, our director of music. Thanks for listening.
Fred Craddock is someone that made it possible for me to consider ministry as a place that I would be able to call home.
Marcus Borg is a person who made a space for me to come back to Christianity after running away.
Fred Craddock is what those of us who are preachers call a preacher for preachers. When Fred started in ministry many, many, many years ago, sermons at that time always followed a simple structure, with each sermon making three precise points. Fred Craddock changed the form of sermons by introducing the power of stories and narrative. Instead of having three points, Craddock just told stories. This crossover tactic made space for people like me to find meaning and life in ministry and to think that I could be a preacher.
Marcus Borg is a New Testament scholar whose research focuses on the historical Jesus. When he began studying Jesus, he was presented with two basic options. One, you could be a fundamentalist Christian scholar, and in doing that, you could make arguments for a literalist Christianity. Or you could be an atheist scholar studying Jesus, and you could make apologetic arguments against Christianity. Borg changed all of that. His love of Jesus and his intellectual rigor were woven together, a crossover tactic that made space for someone like me to find their way back into the large tent of Christianity.
This morning, on This Christian Life, we'll hear stories of crossover tactics, stories that Fred Craddock has told, stories from Marcus Borg and others, as we reflect together on Acts 4, verses 5 through 12.
Act 1, by what power did you do this? Fred Craddock shares a story like this. Last fall, my wife Nettie and I attended a victory party following a University of Georgia football game. We didn't know anybody there except for the couple that we were in attendance with. The home, though, was marvelous. It was one of those Victorians that had been restored. It was well-appointed with high ceilings. Everything about it was beautiful and expensive. And there were a lot of people there, maybe 35 or 40 folks making their way into this home. And they were all in their 30s or 40s, maybe a few in their young 50s. And they were all dressed in that kind of clothing that says, "How about them dogs?" It was quite an exciting thing. This was his first Georgia football game. We emptied the cars and we went inside. We put away our coats. The host and the hostess had put out these sandwiches, you know, the kind at those parties. And there were drinks that were there. And then we went into that kind of awkward moment where everybody is trying to make sure that everyone else knows someone in the space. And there was this attractive woman that was there. Fred doesn't remember her name, but she was too bejeweled and overdressed to have just come from a football game. She was dripping with success, and so was her husband, and seemed like so were most of the people there. And all of a sudden, she stood up in front of all of the folks gathered and said, "I think we ought to sing the doxology." Now, since a lot of us aren't from Georgia, we don't know what the doxology is, but it's this moment in traditional worship as the offering comes up that we sing together. And before they could even vote on it, she already started in. She sang with gusto. Most of the people stood there counting their two shoelaces. Some were trying to find a place to put their drink because it's just not appropriate to hold a drink while you're singing the doxology. Fred just felt uncomfortable in the whole thing. When she finished singing it, this beautiful woman looked out across everybody and said, mostly to the men, "You can talk all you want about the running of Herschel Walker, but it is Jesus that brought us this victory." And somebody said, "Do you really believe that?" "Well, of course," she said. "Jesus says, whatever you ask, ask it in my name, and he'll give it to you. So I said, Jesus, I want to win more than anything." And we won. "I'm not ashamed to say it. This is because of Jesus. Because I'm not ashamed of the gospel." So Craddock moved to the kitchen because this was just pretty uncomfortable for everybody that was in the space. Most everyone was starting to go silent. She continued, "I'm not ashamed to say this anywhere. Because Jesus told us to shout it from the housetops." He could hear her from the kitchen. She was still going. And by this moment, the hostess had walked in, and so silence had kind of taken over the kitchen. And in the silence, somebody looked at him and said, "Do you think that woman's drunk?" "Well, I don't even know. I just moved here from Georgia a year ago. Like, I'm kind of excited that Georgia won, but I'm not all feverish about it like she is." As the hostess started to make her way around, making sure that everyone had their sandwiches, she said, and I'm going to quote her so I don't get in trouble, "If she doesn't shut her damn mouth, she is going to ruin my party." And then Craddock did something that surprised them. He doesn't know why he said it. He never says these things. He said, "Are you a Christian?" She said, "Yes, but I don't believe in shouting it everywhere."
The next day, their rulers, elders, and scribes assembled in Jerusalem with Annas, the high priest, Caiaphas, John, and Alexander, and all who were of the high priestly family. When they had made the prisoners stand in their midst, they inquired, "By what power or by what name did you do this?" Act 2. I was wrong. Fred Craddock shares this story about his own family. "My mother took us to church and to Sunday school. My father didn't go. He complained about Sunday dinner being late whenever she came home from church. Sometimes the preacher would call, and my father would say, 'I know what the church wants. Church doesn't care about me. Church wants another name, another pledge. Another name, another pledge, right? Isn't that the name of it? Another name, another pledge.' That's what my father always said. Sometimes we'd have a revival, and the pastor would bring the evangelist and say to the evangelist, 'There's one now. Sick him, get him, get him.' And my father would say the same thing. Every time, my mom in the kitchen always got nervous. She was afraid of flaring tempers or of somebody getting hurt. And always, my father said, 'Church doesn't care about me. Church wants another name, another pledge.' I guess I heard it 1,000 times. One time, he didn't say it. He was in the veterans hospital and he was down to 73 pounds. They'd taken out his throat and said, "It's too late." They put in a metal tube and x-rays had burned Dad to pieces. I flew in to see him. Dad couldn't speak and he couldn't eat. I looked around the room. There were potted plants and cut flowers on all the windowsills. A stack of cards 20 inches deep beside his bed. And even, you know, that tray where they put food if you can eat, on that tray was a flower. And all the flowers beside the bed, every card, every blossom, they were all from persons or groups from the church. Dad saw me pick up and read a card. He could not speak. So he took a Kleenex box and wrote on the side of it a line from Shakespeare. "If Dad had not written this line, I would not tell you this story." He wrote, "In this harsh world, draw your breath in pain to tell my story." I said, "What is your story, Daddy?" And he wrote, "I was wrong."
Then Peter, filled with the Holy Spirit, said to them, "Rulers of the people and elders, if we are questioned today because of a good deed done to someone who was sick and are asked how this man has been healed, let it be known to all of you and to all the people of Israel that this man is standing before you in good health by the name of Jesus Christ of Nazareth, whom you crucified, whom God raised from the dead. This Jesus is the stone that was rejected by you, the builders. It has become the cornerstone." The only way. Marcus Borg shared a story like this one a while back. That Christianity is the only way of salvation has been familiar to Christians for centuries. For a long time, our Christian ancestors took this for granted. They lived in lands where everybody was Christian or everybody was supposed to be. They seldom, if ever, had contact with people of other religious traditions. The exception was in cities where there were Jewish folks. But Jews were consistently seen by them as having rejected Jesus as the only way. In words attributed to Peter in Acts 4:12, "There is salvation in no one else other than Jesus, for there is no other name under heaven given among mortals by which we must be saved." These words testify to the experience of Jesus's followers. Sometimes we try to take them out of that context. See, these are folks who had experienced radical liberation, freedom, a sense of salvation and deliverance, healing and wholeness. They had been returned from exile. In a way, they were born again in the love of Jesus. And out of those lived experiences, they shared boldly, "Jesus is the way." It's also a language of love. Like the words that lovers use for their beloved. So when you say to your beloved, "You're the most beautiful person in the world," you're not making a factual statement that everybody should agree with. See, somebody overhearing you might think, "The most beautiful person in the world? Attractive, maybe, but not the most beautiful person in the world." And they would miss the point. They would miss the language of love and devotion, of delight and commitment. See, that's part of what it is to say that Jesus is the only way.
"In no one else, for there is no other name under heaven given among mortals by which we must be saved.
Act 4, The Only Way. My mom was a teacher for children with special needs for most all of my childhood, and Kent was one of her students, and Kent had autism. He had very particular ways for doing everything. He'd lay out all of his clothes the night before school as he was getting ready for bed. He would place his shoestrings at very particular angles. And when he got dropped off at school, he had a very set ritual of how he would enter, how he'd get from the door to his room. And it meant touching in a certain pattern most every single screw that he went past. And so there would be a water fountain, and he would dive to the left and touch the screws around it. And then there would be a doorknob, and he would dive back to the right. And you did not want to interrupt this. If you threw off Kent's ritual, everything about the day for everyone else around him was going to go in a very bad direction. It was not going to be pretty. Kent only spoke in the third person, and he repeated everything that he said and most everything that you said. You'd ask, "Kent, how was lunch today?" And he'd say, "Kent, how was lunch today?" And then you'd say, "Kent, how was lunch today? Kent, how was lunch today?" And you'd say, "Kent, how was lunch today?" And then finally he might say, "Kent's lunch was apples and peanut butter on bread." That was about the very best that Kent could do in fitting in to the norms that we have around him. He could describe facts and he could echo. And Kent was one of the many children that I was taught by my mom to love. But the Christian communities that I found myself in high school and college, they didn't know what to do with Kent or what to do with me when I asked questions about Kent. And it was uncomfortable. See, they'd quote Acts 4:12, "There is salvation in no one else. For there is no other name under heaven given among mortals by which we must be saved." And then I'd ask, "Well, what about Kent? He can't even speak in the first person, much less tell us what he believes cognitively." See, I'd been taught by a family to love Kent, and I couldn't imagine a God who didn't love him as well. Most of my friends in those Christian communities, they didn't want to condemn Kent to hell, but they couldn't really imagine another way for Kent either. Mostly what they imagined was me going away with those questions. And so I did. I ran away. And then in college, I ran headlong into a religious studies class, and somebody named Marcus Borg that I never heard of. And Borg's writings showed me that the way that I'd been taught to follow Jesus in these Christian communities in high school and college, that's not the only way. That's not the only way. See, Borg says, to say that Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life is to say that what we see in Jesus is the way and the truth and the life. It's not about knowing the word Jesus and then believing everything that's said about him. Rather, the way is what we see in his actual life. And that's a life of loving God and loving others. A life of challenging the powers that be, the powers that oppress. It's a life radically centered on God to whom Jesus bore witness. And Borg continued, "So can one know the way, the truth, and the life apart from Jesus? For me, the answer is yes. The enduring religions of the world all include lovers of God and saints in whom one can see the way and the truth and the life. But for those of us who are Christians, who seek to follow in the ways of Jesus, we see the way and the truth and the life preeminently in Jesus. So for us, he is our way, our truth, our life.
There is salvation in no one else, for there is no other name under heaven given among mortals by which we must be saved.
Five, the only way. A friend of mine was early in her ministry. She was deeply conflicted in a church that was itself conflicted, and she was working long hours, and her stress level was through the roof. So about that time is when her supervisor had her annual review. Isn't that how it works for everyone? So my friend went and sat in the chair at her supervisor's office, and she realized that her elbows were up on the table and her arms were, and the supervisor didn't even need to see or hear her speak. She just said, "You're the bent over woman." You see, not everyone knows the story of the bent over woman. It's in the New Testament. It's a story about Jesus being in the synagogue, and while he's in the synagogue, he notices a woman who is permanently bent over. And he does the unexpected, the thing that crosses religious boundaries. On the Sabbath, he tells her to get up and to walk, and she does. See, my friend did not want to hear that she was the bent over woman, but it was true. It was sobering for her to realize that she didn't feel any life in her. She was supposed to be at the beginning of ministry, and it was supposed to feel alive always, and it didn't. And her supervisor looked at her and told her to get up and walk. To get up and to walk and to take the rest of this week to rest. So my friend and her partner got in their little beat-up car, and they drove north through the wheat fields of Kansas. It was fall. So it was golden, you know, starting to turn some of those dark browns. The plains were rolling and the skies were clear. They came all the way up toward Atchison, Kansas. I'm from the area. Atchison is in the middle of nowhere. The very middle of nowhere. And to get into Atchison, you'd kind of go up the highway, over a river, and then you start to see it. As they did this, as they rose up over the Missouri River, they could see Atchison, and my friend noticed a cross on a hillside. And this cross was calling to her. So she and her partner wound through the streets, and they kept getting closer. They kept turning, trying to find their way toward this cross that kept calling. And then eventually they stumbled on a monastery. It was quiet and it was beautiful. It seemed like there was no one there. So they parked their car and they got out to just take it all in, to just be in the beauty of that place. As they wandered, they moved past the main building, and a huge door swung open, and a little nun with white hair called out, "Welcome. We are glad you're here." My friend didn't know what to say. They just stumbled on this space. And again, the small nun cried out, "Come in, come in. We are so glad that you're here." And she ended up taking my friend around for a tour of the whole facility. She invited her to stay for Vespers and to pray with their community. "Come back whenever you feel led. Stay as long as you need to." And my friend, who was longing for life to be revived, started to take her up on that. And every month she would return to that monastery and she would work in the library, serve in that way, and just take in the beauty of that space. But the thing is, this monastery that she happened to stumble upon is a Benedictine monastery. And in the Benedictine monastery, there is a rule or a way for you to live. And the rule or the way for all Benedictines is that let everyone that comes be received as Christ. See, hospitality for Benedictines means that everyone who comes in the door, the poor, the outcast, the traveler, the one of some other religion, the one who doesn't even know where they are, all means all, are welcomed into that space. They are accepted in the name of Christ. That's their rule. That's their way. Maybe it's a crossover tactic. This little nun opening this door, welcoming and practicing hospitality. See, the name by which she's saved is Christ. And that name of Christ is expressed, it's manifest in welcome, in hospitality. And for my friend on that day, salvation.
God's love poured open to make us new. Lord, make us new. The body.